Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Welcome back to Masters of Modern. I am your host, Alex Kessler, here with my co-hosts, Ben Bateman and Michael Grothy. I lift them up while I raise the roof. This is the MMCast podcast. We are previously the Master of Modern podcast, but also do modern content. Last week, we did a whole thing, modern content all the time. So check that out. And then today, we're doing deck techs on historic, as well as some commander deck techs. We've been brewing some commander content, and then we've also been playing a lot of historic on Arena. And me and Michael have some spicy lists that Ben also has experience with, so we're going to talk about those today. And talk about how maybe you could take them in the modern as well. Thank you really quickly to our patrons, top of the podcast. You guys make this happen. If you are interested, one cool thing you get for being a patron is the raw feed. You get a full, generally 10 minutes worth of extra content every week at the very beginning of the episode, audio only, but on the patron, that is about random stuff. This week we talked about NSYNC and Backstreet Boys pretty thoroughly. We went through the careers of every member. Really, it could have been its own podcast, breaking down the lives and careers of each Backstreet Boy and NSYNC vendor, and the New Direction as well.
One Direction.
Come on, have some respect for 1D.
No. And so today, and I might be peeking a little bit, so I'm going to turn my mic a little bit down.
That 1D conversation just got him too excited, Michael.
I know, I was too hyped. I peaked. That was it. Life's downhill from now. That's you. You could listen to the moment that my life peaked if you donate to our patron and check that out and see the raw feed. We're trying something new on the YouTube channel. So definitely, if you're an audio subscriber, please check out the YouTube channel. We release video content all the time now. That's the new thing we're doing, is these episodes that are normally about like an hour and 30 minutes long to an hour long, where Marshall is splitting them up into bite-sized 20-minute average chunks and releasing each of those different days. So there's going to be different subject matters throughout the episode, and each of them will be their own thing. For instance, today we're going to be talking about a couple decks. Each of those will be its own episode. It's something we're trying out. It should be pretty cool. I hope you guys like it. Last week we did it with some awesome guests. The week before that was Thanksgiving. The week before that we did our set review for Commander Legends, and we broke that into five different episodes by color. It's a whole new world out there.
Trying out new stuff.
A new fantastic point of view.
And when you guys are watching and listening to this, if you don't mind, leave comments. Leave comments on these videos about what you think, because when you comment, when you leave a comment, the videos do better. And it also lets us know that you like, maybe dislike what we're doing, but we would rather know than not know. So please leave a comment, hit that thumbs up button.
Yeah, yeah. If you like it, we'll like you. Just automatically. I will conscientious like you more if you hit the like button. Hi, everyone. Today we're talking about deck lists. And the first one we're going to talk about today is a historic list that I got off of Wizards top five performing deck list of that week list at some point a while back, and then have been jamming a bunch of games with and had really, really good success with it. Pretty much the list is exactly the same. There's small differences to the main. I like cut two Grafdigger's Cages and add two Tormod's Crypts because I don't want to waste wild cards on Grafdigger's Cages. I don't own any, because that's the world we live in. But Tormod's Crypt is fine. I haven't ran against too many decks that I needed that as a sideboard card, so I might cut that in the long run anyways. But it's really sweet. And basically, it is a you lose the game tribal deck. So it has four packs of negation, two Glorious Ends, one Chance for Glory, and it's running three Gideon of the Trials, using the ability of Gideon to just like stay in play and make it so you never lose the game with his ultimate or his zero ability. Which, for those who don't know, if it's zero, if you were to lose the game, you don't. If you control Gideon, it's an emblem.
Create an emblem.
And then Chance for Glory gives you an extra turn, and all your creatures are indestructible, but you lose the game. Glorious End ends the turn, so you can use it as a counterspell. or you can use it to just end your opponent's turn before they draw a card. And then Pact of Negation is a free counterspell that at the beginning of your upkeep, you lose the game. And they all kind of work really well, and it's a general blue, white, red control list. So it's playing a bunch of counter magic, planeswalkers, torrential gear hulks, Wrath of Gods, Elsbeth the Conqueror's Death, Narsets, etc., etc.
Yeah, it's a sweet list here. It's interesting. It's funny that we both ended up playing this list separately, because I had my own version of this. I was playing maybe like a month and a half, 2 months ago. It was before Kaladesh. When you showed me this list, the big question I had was, how come you're only playing three Gideons? Because the whole like you lose the game aspect of these cards, they're really tough cards to play, obviously, if you don't have the right setup. They're very dead if your opponent figures out what you're doing. Pact of Negation is great, and that was like the whole, for me, that was like the big motivator for the deck, right? Was because this is a good control card, so if I get to five lands, like I can just use this. I don't need, but the other ones are like kind of a tough sell if you don't have a Gideon, obviously. They're just kind of dead.
So it's a few things. One, Fire Prophecy and Maze Mind Tomes both let you kind of dig to them, to the Gideons you need. So the fact that their redundancy is not the best when they're redundant, Elsbeth Conqueror's Death also can get them back if you need them. And honestly, it's just they haven't been that much of an issue. Three has seemed pretty close to enough. You also have Narsets to dig for them. So you have like enough ways to kind of get to them. And just being able to play a wider selection of cards that do well, or something like a Shark Typhoon. There's like maybe an argument that Sublime Epiphany could be a fourth Gideon of the Trials. But Sublime Epiphany with Torrential Gearhulk is such a like massive beating that it's worth kind of trying to make that happen. But in testing, I haven't had an issue. I like there's been like maybe one or two games where like, oh man, I wish I like drew a second Gideon because they killed the first one. But being able to dig, honestly, the biggest surprising card from playing it is Maid's Mind Tome. That card has been consistently overperforming. The fact that it like, for two mana, you get to just kind of scry train, right? You just keep scrying, which is really good. Once you start having like mana that you're floating because you want to counter something and they don't play anything into it, you can use it to draw a card. And then they like, when I first read the card, when it was first printed, I thought, oh, you only get four tries on this and then you just like, it goes away. But actually gaining that four life is super relevant. It like gives you just enough to stabilize so that at that point, every counter spell you have locks the game out for you.
I also think that Maze Mind Tome is interesting in decks like this because there is Planeswalker removal like that's pretty common now. Like people are playing, you know, Murderous Rider or whatever, or Eat to Extinction, or like they just are attacking Planeswalker on more removal spells. But Maze Mind Tome acts kind of like a Planeswalker in that it like draws you cards turn after turn and you have to answer it or else you'll lose. Or at least get buried in card advantage, but it's not like a planeswalker in that like your opponent can't attack it, your opponent can't remove it with cards that are in their main deck. And really, if your opponent is going to board in artifact removal against your deck with two artifacts in it, you're fine. There are a lot of like non-blue decks that are playing like maybe some artifact ramp in historic, like Mindstones, or sometimes they're like the monocolorless decks are playing it and stuff. Yep. And those decks obviously are bringing in artifact removal, you kill their Maze Mind Tome, whatever. But in decks like this, where like it's the only artifact in your deck and you're just leaning on it for card advantage, like your opponent can't really board against it, so it just goes unchecked.
It's also interesting too, so I only have exclusively played Arena in Best of One. I like haven't played almost any sideboard Best of Three traditional. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little bit of a different ball game, right? Like you want your main deck to be like somewhat balanced and then have that like optionality in game two. The way that my list was built is a little bit more like I don't have as many things that I can swap out easily in game two.
You don't get bad matchups. So you don't like if you have a bad matchup, you lose. So you get one chance to try and win. So every card in your main deck needs to be specific and work against as many opponents as possible. So like Timely Reinforcements, for instance, is not the best. Or Sweltering Suns is maybe not. Well, actually, probably pretty good in Best of One, but because you can always cycle.
You also have, I mean, the stuff that I see in your list here that really stands out to me is like there's just a lot of traditional control cards in here that are really good control cards. You know, like you're playing obviously Planeswalkers to win the game, but you're playing like three Ionize and an Absorb, and you're playing Timely, which is a great example of a card that you would obviously want to play in a deck like that. Torrential Gearhulk, like Sublime Epiphany, you know, Shark Typhoon. These are really just super solid control cards. Whereas I think the list I was playing feels like it's just a little bit more all in on the concept, and it's a little more dependent on getting the Gideon. If I don't get the Gideon, the deck's a lot harder to make work. So I was playing cards to dig for it. Like I was playing Board the Weatherlight, I also played like three Narsets because I think Narset's the best card to be digging for Gideon in the whole deck. It's like always a good card to play. But then I, instead of you've got a Teferi in here. I was playing two copies of Mono Blue Teferi.
The 4-mana one.
It also makes sense. It also makes sense for you to be playing more Gideons if your deck is like more about Gideon, because the deck that Alex has been playing is pretty much a Jeskai control deck with like a few stinkers in it, and then Gideon to make the stinkers into insane cards. What's interesting about Historic is that Pact of Negation is actually kind of just good. Like, it's not as bad as it is in Modern because you're hitting 5 mana pretty much every game, and like you can do kind of the current standard thing where you like jam some insane 4 or 5 drop like an Uro or Nissa or Teferi or something and just defend it with Pact of Negation.
Yep.
Well, yeah, like,
because you're tapping out for your Teferi, and if they try and counter or whatever, you're like, Pact, I don't care. Like, literally, I'll spend 10 mana on this Teferi, whatever. It's going to win the game.
I totally agree. I mean, Alex, I put my list here in the bottom of the chat if you want to check it out and see how it compares. But it's basically like all the cards that are not as good as cards you're playing for the purpose of trying to be cuter. So like, I'm even playing like a single copy of Urza's Ruinous Blast because I play so many Planeswalkers and artifacts in the deck. And, you know, like, it was a total house in some games where I'd wipe the entire board and keep my whole board because they're all legendary. I'm playing two copies of Mox Amber so that I have more things to dig for with Bord the Weatherlight. I'm playing so many Planeswalkers. I played a copy of Aether Spellbomb for a long time. I do have Soul Guide Lantern in here, like you said, Michael. I played Birth of Meletus because it's, again, a card that I can hit with Bord. Like, so it's definitely the same concept. The big add for me at the end that pushed the deck into like starting to work finally, because I lost a lot with it, was the 2 Sphinx's Revs that I had. That was the key card that I like turned it around, because I could cycle it relatively early if I needed to, but it also, with all of the like draw discard of the Teferis, and I think I'm playing a single copy of Royal Scions in there, you would just get to a situation where you had burned all your cards and you were trying to win with a Gideon, and like, end of turn, I'll draw 7. Like, you have no chance of coming back now.
Right. I like really like Platinum Angel in your list, the one of. I think that's like super spicy and something that like people forget is available in Historic, as like, this is a control deck, right? Like, I'm planning on casting Shark Typhoons and Torrential Gearhulks and Sublime Epiphanies. Playing a Platinum Angel with a Pact of Negation backup is like not a non-zero game plan or non-zero chance game plan, and like, that's super spicy, right? That's Gideon number 5 and is good on its own access, which I like it. Yeah,
and
that's
you can
really
grab
cool.
it with Bord the Weatherlight, of course.
I sort of hate Bord the Weatherlight, I have to be honest. It's the card
that I hate.
I hate that the most in this deck. I like have tried a lot of ways to make this deck work, but the problem is the reason your version, I think, Alex, works so well is because you are a control deck, so you can still just win by playing good control cards. Mine is playing a lot of bad cards to enable the engine, and so if you don't get the engine going, it's just a deck of bad cards.
Yeah, the one thing I noticed in this that I think like maybe you were trying to take advantage of, but might not actually have been that good, other than with Teferi Master of Time, it would be really good with my Teferi, is Chance for Glory is fine. It like wins you the game if you get it to work, but like for the most part, it's just a like. Like, I've like, that's the card I've most looked at, like Glorious End, just to cut it for a third Glorious End. Because like Glorious End, when it's good, is like, it's a counter spell plus a discard spell plus Time Walk that like, and you can cast it. What's cool about Glorious End too, that like I kind of didn't put together when I was first started playing the deck, is you have until the turn after you cast it to put Gideon into play. So what the real game plan is cast Glorious End, countering their spell, then untap, and then play your Gideon. So you're protecting your Gideon until the turn you need to have it in play. So like, both, what's cool about Pact, and I think this is why the deck gets away with only running 3, is both Glorious End and Pact work really well to protect your Gideon in opposite ends, right? Glorious End allows you to just cast Glorious End, and then you can play Gideon in response to it happening. And Pact of Negation lets you play Gideon and then counter whatever they, you know, we're going to cast to try and get rid of Gideon. So like on both ends, Gideon can be well timed to what you're doing.
Because Glorious End can be played as a reactive spell, whereas Chance for Glory is purely proactive, but you're a reactive deck, or Alex's deck is a reactive deck. Perhaps Chance for Glory makes more sense in Ben's more proactive plan.
But I had the same experience. I mean, because the funny thing is about a deck like this, so if you have the Gideon down, playing it for 3 is actually not that much better than playing it for five as just Time Warp, it doesn't actually feel very different. It ends up being most of the time kind of the same thing. I'm like getting this super janky three mana Time Walk, and if I don't have Gideon, I just lose. Like, there are also those situations where you're going to lose and you have to gamble by playing it to just like buy yourself an extra turn in case you maybe are able to dig into something. And those turns like really suck because you often lose on those turns. That was the card. Chance for Glory is definitely the weakest card for me. I don't play any Glorious Ends in mine. I played a bunch in the beginning, but it actually, the way now if you describe it as a counterspell and a discard spell, it makes a lot more sense. It seems like way better.
Because you can see what they're going to do, because sometimes they're just going to like play a doofus creature into your Wrath of God, or they're going to dig, or they're going to do something you don't care. They're going to play like a Planeswalker that you can just attack with Gideon or whatever. But if they play something that's going to hurt you, like they're going to play something that answers your Gideon, or they're going to play like some threat that you can't answer or whatever, you can Glorious End them. And you don't have to use it proactively. You can hold up a counterspell, or you can hold up whatever. And then it's like, you know what? I think this one needs a Glorious End or whatever.
Well, because correct me if I'm wrong here, but like if you play Glorious End when they tap out for Hydroid Crisis, they don't get anything, right?
Correct.
They get nothing.
Yeah, and turn ends. And that's like the move, because like one of the big things that I've found with the deck is that they play their Hydroid Crisis if they're a big ramp deck, and you're like Pact of Negation, but you like still get all these cards and all this life.
And I'm like mostly sure that also you exile everything that's on the stack, so you also get Uro.
Yeah,
not that that's right, you do. Yeah.
I believe everything on this deck gets exiled.
That's so much better than what I was doing.
So one thing I do would say about, and this is kind of what's cool about looking different lists and where people come from, right? Like this, I'm not going to take credit for this, right? Someone else made this, did really well with it. I found the list, and I wish I could remember where I found it, because it was just like doom scrolling on Twitter at some point. But
yeah,
what's cool about your list that's different is like what's cool about Chancellor Glory. Is there's a way of building the shell that is a Planeswalker Tribal shell that Chance for Glory then is insane, right? And you're kind of already doing it with the Sagas. Like, Sagas and Planeswalkers both, like, really love extra turns. So, like, yep. I would lean more into, like, how many Elsbeth Conquers Deaths can I be playing out of this list? And, like, how many different ways, or, like, Planeswalkers. The problem is that most of your Planeswalkers don't care in your original list about extra turns, yep. Right? Because, like, you're not playing Ashiok plus or minus hurt. You're playing or them. You play Ashiok so that they can sit in play and ruin your opponent's day or exile a graveyard once. Gideon the Trials doesn't care after you zero him, his loyalty doesn't matter. Narset, you get two triggers and you're done. Royal Scions is probably your best one after Teferi.
I have ulted Royal Scions in this list a bunch of times, mm-hmm. and it's a really sweet feeling. Like, that card's really sweet. That card, I think, is pretty underrated, actually. I find that people kind of ignore the card. They, like, don't care about it very much. But the fact that it digs you to what you want, can refill your hand if you get enough turns with it, and also means your Gideon kill plan gets even faster if you don't want to dig. You're just like, now that I have the game locked down, I have these, like, two backup counter spells, I'm just going to dome you for six a turn.
Mm-hmm.
Both pluses too. So like if you just have a good hand, you can like, I'll just get you for two more, and eventually you're still gonna get to ult. I think that five mana Teferi is something that like is worth thinking about for any, like, even if you're a planeswalker-y version of this and less counter spells, like what Alex is playing, where Alex is like a control deck with some planeswalkers. If you were like planeswalker tribal, maybe keeping the Urza's Ruinous Blast, I feel like Teferi plays really well with Chance for Glory or Glorious End because of the untapped two lands.
Yeah.
And the fact that like taking an extra turn with Chance for Glory or taking an extra turn with Glorious End like benefits Teferi because he ticks up, he draws a card, he gets closer to ultimate, which if you ultimate Teferi, you're winning the game. So, I feel like 5-minute Teferi works really well in this deck. And another thing I really like about what Alex is doing, which I don't know if this works as well for like a Planeswalker tribal deck, but Torrential Gearhulk I think is really cool in the deck because it allows you to cut copies of Glorious End and Chance for Glory, which are like situational. But you still get the same number of that effect, right? Because if you have a Glorious End in your graveyard or a Chance for Glory, which hopefully by the time you're casting Torrential Gearhulk, you've played one at some point, this Torrential Gearhulk can just be another copy. So you get like more copies of your best effect, your key effect, but you don't have to like dedicate slots to a card that is potentially bad.
I agree. When I read the Gearhulk, when I like read the Gearhulk, I was like, oh yeah, this is... Because the one thing that my deck would do, and I would notice this time and time again, this is one of the reasons I put in the Platinum Angel, is it would get the engine going, but it would be super dirtily, because like without the right threat, or if they have like blockers or like some way for you don't close the game out fast enough. And then you're not taking advantage of your extra turns. You're not actually taking advantage of the velocity, which is where well, your list is better, Alex, because like you have all the counter spells and you have all the like all the ways to actually close out the game. The Gear Hulk, I mean, there's two copies of Gear Hulk in your list, and I think for a reason. Like getting a big threat and also an effect is the point, and that's kind of the. I mean, Gideon is an amazing magic card. Mm-hmm. It's incredible, like how it's built to make the strategy like this work, because like you both get the I don't lose and you get a 4/4. But it's such an important card to my list, because if I don't have Gideon, the deck doesn't work and I don't have a win condition.
Right, right. The one of the cool things about Torrential Gear Hulk, like just like two things, is the commit strategy as well. You can target commit, but cast memory off of a Gear Hulk, because yeah. It casts the, you can like, it plays with the instant sorcery.
The way Aftermath is worded is it's like, if you play this from your graveyard, you can cast the Aftermath half or something weird like that, that it works with Gear Hulk.
Well, it's Gear Hulk can target because it's an instant, but then once it's exiled,
you can target it because it's an instant, half. But you can choose to cast the Aftermath.
Yes. You know what? Aftermath card I've been like super stoked on, and I find that I like more and more. Insult Injury, that card's real sweet. Like that, like the fact that for three mana you get like a shock effectively. I think you get it's like a creature and a player. I want to say
no, it's four mana. That's the Aftermath.
It's two and a red. Damage can't be prevented this turn. If a source you control would deal damage this turn, it deals double that damage instead. And then two and a red, Injury, Aftermath. Cast a spell only from your graveyard, then exile it. Injury deals two damage to target creature and two damage to target player or planeswalker.
Yeah, it's like a really sweet card. It's pretty aggressively costed for what it's doing, because the front half can just win the game out of nowhere sometimes. And then the back half, if you have enough mana, often can, you know, be like a total swing, right? Like 4 points to a planeswalker and 4 points to a creature.
Also, yeah, or if you like just play Insult and you have lethal on board, but they have a removal spell or something and you don't kill them, like you're not really down a card. You have a three mana shock in your graveyard, which is not impressive, but it's like...
Yeah, it's been
something.
It's probably the Aftermath card, I would say, that when the set was spoiled and we did our review of it, it's probably the one that I read that I was the most excited about, that I've actually been like, I guess Claim Fame is actually the one, but this is definitely the card that I read that I was like, this is going to be good, that I in the end was like, oh, this was actually good. I was correct about this.
How do you feel? How has Birth of Lidus been?
Pretty interesting. I think that card's pretty good. I used to think it was kind of garbage. Like playing against it, I would always be like, I don't care about this. But that's because I was playing a rogues deck where everything like had flying and I had counter spells. But in general, I think that card's pretty good. I think the fact like, so one of the great lessons I have learned from you, Alex, over the years is that things early that get you a land, like that just put lands into your hand that have any other effect, tend to be pretty good. And I hate playing lands and I hate playing expensive things. So I like usually ignore those cards. But Historic, obviously, because it's restrictions, like there's only certain things available. I happened on it because of the board, the Weatherlight strategy. And what I realized was like this deck just needs to hit its land drops. It needs to curve out. It needs to make sure that it can get to five to protect back to negation in time. It like all those things. And so I think I play three planes in my list. And it's like I've been pretty consistently impressed with the card.
It's like it's better than Wall of Omens 30% of the time, and then much worse 70% of the time. Well, like Wall of Omens cantrips into a card, 30% of your deck is lands. It's 30% kind of going to draw you a land. This also gains you two life. But then
it's one of the places that I've been most
that you don't draw a land. Wall of Omens is, and it's better than that, right? Because like there's a 10% of the time where you want a land. That you don't draw land, and there's the 10% of the time. Yeah.
I think one of the places I've been the most impressed with it is that the mono red deck is just a super annoying deck to play against in Historic. I like hate that deck with all my heart. I kind of hate mono red in every format, but Historic especially I hate it, because your velocity to punish them fast enough is usually not really there, and it's really fast. The Prowess one, the Wizards one, actually the Rakdos one's really good too, but the Prowess one especially is really good. Like that deck is just really fast. So having something that gets you, draws you into a land to make sure you can cast your cards, gets you a 0/4 blocker and gains you two life, pretty good against them. It's mm-hmm. It's a pretty solid card against them.
Yeah.
What have you found in playing Historic for both of you guys? What have you found is like the most essential piece of the format? Because like my big realization is I played a lot of the Rogues deck and then this deck and had another couple that I messed around with, was that you really, really need creature-based interaction. You have to be able to not, like, the Goblins deck, for instance, will just roll you over if if you're not able to interact with them early. And there's I would say there's a handful of decks like that. The Elves deck is kind of like that. The Goblins deck is kind of like that.
Losing to Goblins is extraordinarily frustrating. Like, Amuxus hitting players, like, okay, this card's dumb. Yeah. I think there's a lot of the list that I'm playing is, like, built in different ways to just, like, try and stop Goblins from killing you, right? It's playing, like, five board wipes. One of them can be done at three mana. It's playing just, like, as many counter spells or, like, Glorious Ends are all good at stopping Goblins from winning. And I think it's, like, built to just, like, how do I chain these into Gear Hulks, eventually making it so they have tried casting all of their Muxuses and I've countered every single one of them. Because, I mean, otherwise,
sending Muxus is like super epic. Oh yeah,
it's real good.
They often are prospectoring into it and sacrificing half their stuff.
They like sack their stuff. They cast Muxus, you Glorious End. They normally do it before their attack step too. So you're like fogging. You're like getting everything you need. They normally will put a, you know, you won't get their land drop. That's like always the small get them where it's like, people learn to play spells after their attack step when Glorious End is in your deck after game one.
The Goblins deck also is interesting too, right? Because there's a couple different cards that you focus on when that deck hits play. So Muxus is their end game. That's how they want to beat you. But there's also the Snoop, who's very good. Snoop is like a big, if they can land a Snoop early that you don't deal with, they can get way far ahead without even winning with Muxus. And then Prospector. It's basically Prospector, Snoop, are the two key cards early that I think you have to kill.
I hate when they play Prospector into Snoop and then Krank goes on top of their deck on turn three or whatever. And I'm like, all right, I guess you're the luckiest and I lose. Cool.
That was what I was going to say. Is that Krenko, I would actually say Krenko is more kill on sight than necessarily Snoop is.
I have lost a lot to Krenko. Well, I mean, Krenko like is four mana and it's like clunkier and they don't always play it out on turn four, but I've lost to Krenko like as much as I've lost to Muxus. Like, there's been plenty of games where like my opponent plays Muxus and I counter it and I'm like, haha, got him. And they're like, Krenko. And I'm like, oh, I'm out of answers. I lose.
No, that I agree with. The thing I was going to say, and I told you guys this before when I was playing the Rogues deck, but I, in the end, was main decking two copies of Witch's Vengeance by the end of the time I was playing the deck. Because it's good. It's legitimately good against like half the format. It like wrecks the Goblin deck because you're one turn faster than a Wrath of God. So if you have any interaction, like combined with like Brazen Borrowers, it's actually pretty hard to lose to them. You can sequence it so that like whatever haste thing they have, you can bounce and then you wrath them on your turn. But like even just honestly, Witch's Vengeance just as a hard cast, just a hard cast kill something, is pretty strong. That card, I think that card's actually, it's funny, we previewed that card and it's like kind of underrated. I think that card's good in Historic.
Modern. How would you port this list? Because you've done that before, right? Like what cards, I know like off the top of my head, just like Angel's Grace is like the main like other Gideon that's like really good. And already there are decks that are playing, you know, Ad Nauseam decks are like taking advantage of Angel's Grace effects.
I mean, you guys remember I played that Delver Pact deck. That's what you're talking about. I had a period of time where I actually purchased all the cards for that deck and like was playing a version of it with Pact of the Titans and Snapcaster Mages and like Angel's Graces. It was like really fun. It was a really stupid deck and it wasn't good enough, but it was a similar concept to this. And the problem with that deck was always that Modern's really fast. So you can't be the tempo version that I wanted to be because resolving Gideon and having the like correct colors to hit all your things and not getting removed or countered or interacted with was so hard to do. Early, you ended up sort of being this tempo deck that like didn't have enough power to play control, but you ultimately like would win the game more often if you hit more land drops and could kind of play control.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, like that deck, the whole like premise with that deck was, I think you could like you had Angel's Graces in the deck so that you could like turn two, end of turn, Pact of the Titan, and then like Snapcaster Mage, making like 2/4/4s at the end of turn two.
Yeah,
that's snap, getting like 10 power into play, and then on upkeep you at Angel's Grace so that you didn't lose to the triggers.
Yeah, I have a Gideon tribal deck that I was messing around with too, and it was like very hard into 4 Snapcaster Mage, 4 Pact of Negation, 4 Pact of the Titan, 4 Angel's Grace, Bolt Path, and then the fact that you can, like, the way Gideon's emblem is worded, it works with all Gideons, right? You don't need Gideon, of the Trials, as long as you have a Gideon in play, his emblem works. So I was playing 4-mana Gideon from Battle for Zendikar and even one Gideon Jura, original Gideon, because like all of them are different versions that kind of like work. And then, yeah, like with Snapcaster Mage, you get a lot of Pact of the Titans into play on turn two, and then can Angel's Grace immediately after that.
I mean, the move probably, honestly, if we're thinking about this deck and we're really trying to make that version of the deck in Modern work, is don't play Delver, play 2-1 Gideon, legendary creature Gideon, and play him on turn one, and then do the thing we just talked about.
What? He doesn't count.
He flips, though, and he counts.
When you flip him, but you have to have... I guess you flip him with the... Hey. With the so you play if, turn
so,
one.
So if you go, yeah, I mean, if you go turn one Gideon, turn two, the thing I talked about with Pact and Snapcaster Mage, you're going to play Angel's Grace and flip him on that turn. Which, like, obviously it's a little janky, but the fact, I do think that if you're trying to go with a more go wide strategy with this, and you definitely want to have a Gideon in play and you want to be aggressive, he's probably the better card. You're probably supposed to play him, not Delver. You're probably supposed to like invest in trying to flip him as early as you can.
See, I almost say like, don't play Delver. You're playing eight copies of Gideon with this and Angel's Grace, but like I would go deep on Glorious. Like Glorious, and I don't think it existed in Magic when I originally brewed this deck. I like found it on my like decked app saved folders brew list that I definitely made on Airplane at some point. But like Going the Glorious end around and not even trying to do the like because a free 4/4s that they have to deal with while you're countering their spells or just have like really good stuff up is going to be so strong against them that I almost think you don't need to like lean into a 2-1. The problem with Kithian is like it costs mana to flip him, right? It doesn't just trigger. You have to
you can make him indestructible for three. He flips if you attack with three.
He flips for free. You just have to have creatures.
The other issue is that so the timing, so like on turn one you have Kithian, on turn two you do this thing where you attack with 2/4/4s, you flip him, but then on that next turn you still have the Angel's Grace because that Gideon isn't the one that gives you the emblem.
Yes, right, that's what I was just realizing after I suggested that, is actually having that Gideon flip is irrelevant if you don't have the other Gideon. I think that's one build of the deck is the thing we're talking about, which is a cool idea if you want to be tempo-y. If you want to try to build exactly the deck we're talking about, which is like a control deck that's taking advantage of the don't lose the game things. Mm-hmm. It's probably honestly not that far from what you have here, Alex. There's a few things that I think are different. Like I think some of your interactions probably a little different, but the interesting thing about this is that some of the cards take like Fire Prophecy, for instance. Fire Prophecy is like a good card for more than one reason. And there's not like a good for Fire Prophecy.
I would play Lightning Bolt over Fire Prophecy.
I mean, for sure. But I guess what I mean is like that,
I think like
you're
like,
not just playing Fire Prophecy to deal with creatures. You're playing Fire Prophecy because it deals with creatures and it digs you into what you need. So like,
sure,
if you're not playing that card, then you need to figure out probably more efficient ways to dig. I do think you're probably playing four copies of Gideon the Trials in the Modern version because it's going to get removed way more often. Your counterspell suite's better. It's cheaper.
Yeah, like you can cut down on lands. You can bring by like bringing in Serum Visions, right? That helps you get rid of the Fire Prophecies. You also like you instead of Torrential Gearhulk and the Gearhulk package, you go to Snapcaster Mage. You also get access to like Jace the Mind Sculptor and other things that let you dig, maybe over Maze Mind's Tomb. Like I think you can like upgrade everything downward. Like everything kind of becomes cheaper to a slightly better version of a card. I think you're right from the point, like most of the cards don't change that much. I think like 3-4 Gideons, Narsets, Glorious Ends, Pact of Negations, Teferi, Wrath of God. Wrath of God maybe goes away. You just don't need it in Modern, right? Like it's not like you don't need board wipes as much as you do. You if anything, you just want more interaction and counter spells. But you get Path, you get Lightning Bolt, you get not Deprive, but the Delve one that my brain is
Logicon.
I think there's a lot of negate. You know, a pact of not pact of negation. The
Force of Negation.
Force of Negation.
Yeah, Force of Negation you get. You can play Remand if you want to, you know, if you want to do that instead of like them having cards is not that important if you are able to like shut them down. So like tempoing your way into it. But yeah, I don't think it's that different. I don't think it's that different at all.
Thank you. Just a middle ad. And thank you, everyone, for watching. Like and subscribe. If this is a video version, there will be one tomorrow. We're doing these now every day of the week. We're splitting up into multiple videos a week. So thank you so much for watching. Next week, we're going to be going over a deck that Michael's been playing in Historic. In the meantime, make sure to follow us on Twitter. I'm at Kes Wiley.
You guys can find me at Ben Bateman Media.
I'm at Dudar, D-U-D-A-R-D-D.
Also, make sure to check out every Monday. We are live streaming both on YouTube and Twitch. Commander Games. I think tonight, if this comes out on Monday, we have ZBEX and a mystery guest that I don't know yet, but it'll be really fun. Definitely check that out. And then, yeah, good times. Now, also thank you to all our patrons. Again, you're the best. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back, or back to the episode. There was probably a commercial break there if you're watching this in audio format. If not, this is a new video. I am your host, Alex Kessler. Today we are talking about, we're doing deck techs. We're doing deck techs all week. We just did a whole deck tech on a Gideon Tribal deck out of Historic and talked about how it could fit in a Modern. And now we are going over a new deck. Michael has been jamming this in Historic. It's been really fun watching him live through Discord. I guess not through Twitch, just Discord streaming. Tell us about the deck.
So it is a blue-black Paradox Engine deck. I got this list from Crokies on Twitter, actually. And I had been looking for a Paradox Engine deck, and I looked around the internet a bit in Historic, because I think Paradox Engine is a super strong combo piece, Banding Commander for a reason. But I also think it's like not quite good enough for Modern, not quite good enough. Maybe this is good enough for Pioneer, actually. I'll be honest, I haven't played a lot of Pioneer since COVID hit immediately after it was introduced as a format, and I didn't really even get a deck together before it was too late. So, actually, I found the remnants of my Pioneer deck that I had started to build, and Treasure Cruise was still in it, and I was like, oh my gosh.
I wish.
It was just like, I'm like putting together cards, I'm like converting my Modern Phoenix list where like Faithless Looting just got banned. I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna do Pioneer, I'm gonna get these the Hour of Devastation cards, Strategic Planning and Treasure Cruise, and I'm gonna play some Phoenix again, and then COVID, and then yeah, Treasure Cruise got banned, and
now we're here.
So yeah. Anyway, maybe there's a version of this that could work in Pioneer, but I do think Paradox Engine is a powerful card, and Historic is not like it's like the weakest format you could play Paradox Engine in, right? So I looked around, and this was the list I liked the most, is this Crokies list. So you play a bunch of eggs. You play 3 Aether Spellbomb, 4 Chromatic Sphere, and 4 Mindstone are your eggs. You also have 2 Mox Amber, which are an egg in that they cost 0, but not an egg because they don't draw you a card. And then you play a couple more Mana Rocks, as well as the Mind Stones and the Ambers. You play 4 Guardian Idol, 4 Power Stone Shard, as well as Renowned Weaponsmith, who taps for 2 mana, but you can only use it to cast an artifact spell or activate the ability of artifacts. But it's 2 mana, and it taps for 2. So it's like, it's pretty incredible if you get to untap with it. But it is a creature very vulnerable to just getting killed.
It's kind of your like Goblin Electromancer, where it's like, if I untap with this, I'm probably going to be very far ahead, but it's
well,
kill
yes.
on sight.
But Electromancer does do something the turn you play it.
Yes.
This guy, yeah. Not so much. But
he's one of, yeah, Weaponsmith is one of the 5 versions they've printed now of the mini Architect, going all the way back to Darksteel when the original one came out. And then there's been this
Vidalcan
one.
Vidalcan Engineer.
Yeah, there's him, there's this one, and I think there's
one
at least
all of them convoke. Right.
Yeah, there's 2. I think there's 4 total. But anyway, keep going.
Yeah. So this guy I do like a little better than Vidalcan Engineer. Vidalcan Engineer taps for colored mana, but like, how often do you really need colored mana for your artifacts? This guy's a 1/3. It also has the ability to, you can pay a blue and tap it to search your library for a Heart Piercer Bow or a Vial of Dragonfire. I'm not playing either of those cards in my deck, but sometimes shuffling your library is important. So
that's funny. That's really cute because you're
you
playing,
can just fail to find.
You're playing Mystic Forge, right? So you can use it to.
I am playing Mystic Forge. I'm getting to it. We're slow rolling the deck tech for the podcast listeners. Okay, so we've got the Mana Rocks, Guardian Idol, 4 Guardian Idol, 4 Power Stone Shard, and 4 Renowned Weaponsmith, who is not an artifact, but he taps for a lot of mana for his mana cost. Guardian Idol and Renowned Weaponsmith also attack Planeswalkers, which is nice. There's been times where like I just need to get it to ferry off the board. Then I'm also playing 4 Emery Lurker of the Lock to recur my eggs, and she is also a combo piece with Paradox Engine, because if you have Emery, an egg, I'm going to use Chromatic Sphere as the example because it's the best egg for this, 1 Mana Rock and 1 Paradox Engine, you can draw your entire deck, because yeah, it's pretty strong. You have to untap with Emery. That's the hard part, because she's also a creature very vulnerable to just getting killed. But you can sacrifice a Chromatic Sphere to make a mana, tap Emery to cast the Chromatic Sphere, and then you have a mana rock. So you tap the mana rock, then you cast a Chromatic Star, untap the mana rock. So now you have one mana. You use to crack the Chromatic Sphere, add a blue. Then you tap your mana rock again, cast the Chromatic Sphere with Emry, because each time Emry is untapping as well as your one mana rock.
Right.
So you're
right,
just netting zero mana each time because Chromatic Star adds one. And then assuming that's all the mana you have, you don't have other mana rocks, once you draw enough of your deck, you'll get a Mox Amber. And then now you're netting one mana every time because now you have two mana rocks that are tapping, but you're only spending one net. You can do the same thing with a Mind Stone, but you need a lot more mana rocks because it's you have to be spending net three mana every time. Sure. And you can do it with an Aether Spell Bomb, but it costs two every time. So Chromatic Sphere is the best because in order to cast, sack, recast, it only is net cost net one.
There's one, two, or three mana, and any of the different level of extra mana you have, the better, more options you have.
Right. It's just redundancy. So that's the first combo. Pretty simple, but it does involve Emry, who's very fragile. But a lot of the time, your opponent will be like, ah, yes, my opponent is infinite. I scoop. The other combo is with Mystic Forge, which there is only one in the main deck. I have thought about adding another one, but I think the list is really tight, and I've played it enough to like know most of the lines. I'm not going to claim to know all the lines, because there's obviously a lot going on with this deck, but I know most of the lines, and I like am pretty good with it. I haven't quite gotten to the point where I like figure out what I want to change about it, but I may add a second Mystic Forge. But Mystic Forge is another combo piece, but what's nice is that it is not a vulnerable creature, and you do not have to untap with it. You can go off the turn you play it, theoretically, assuming you have enough mana. So Mystic Forge allows you to look the top card of your library at any time. You may cast artifacts and colorless spells from the top of your library. You can tap it and pay one life to exile the top card of your library. So what you can do with this is, once you have Paradox Engine and Mystic Forge, it's a card advantage engine, first off. So you can just play it out on turn four and start casting spells from the top of your deck and effectively drawing cards.
Which is why the Weaponsmith earlier is good, because you can use it to, if you have a land on top that you can't play or a colored spell that you can't play, you can use Weaponsmith to shuffle your deck.
Right, you can use respin. Weaponsmith to shuffle your deck. Blue mana is at a bit of a premium, but sometimes you gotta. The Weaponsmith is also good. I guess the two mana creature that adds two means you can just turn three Paradox Engine if you think your opponent doesn't have a way to remove it. Like in a lot of game ones where I'm pretty sure my opponent doesn't have artifact removal, I can just jam turn three Paradox Engine and then turn four do some nasty stuff with Renowned Weaponsmith.
Sick.
Mana. So the Mystic Forge, yeah, it's card advantage engine, but it also allows you to combo with Paradox Engine, although it's a little bit looser combo because you can fizzle. But what you're doing is you have mana rocks in play. You're just playing a card off the top, like floating all your mana, playing a card off the top, untapping, playing another card off the top, floating all your mana, like, and you're like netting mana each time, hopefully, because you have enough mana rocks. Like, you have a ton of cheap artifacts in your deck that allow you to net mana. And then, same thing with Emry. You're like pretty much playing all the cards in your deck, making a ton of mana. The trick is that you can hit lands on top, or you can hit colored spells on top, like the Weaponsmith or the Emry. And what you have to do then is you can tap the Mystic Forge to exile a top card of your library. And if you do that, it's tapped. But now you can play a card, and the Paradox Engine will untap your Mystic Forge, so you get another chance. So each time you play a card, you get another chance to get rid of the top. Now, sometimes you like exile the top. It was a land or a colored spell. You know, you exile your island. There's an Emry on top. Now you're Mystic Forge is tapped, you got nothing to cast in your hand, but you can draw cards with a bunch of stuff in the deck. So you can crack a Mind Stone, or you can crack a Chromatic Sphere to hopefully clear the top. You can shuffle with the Renowned Weaponsmith, for example, who will untap eventually, and you can use them again. So you have a lot of ways to kind of reset the top card to try and like continue comboing, but you can fizzle if you like get unlucky and there's like a bunch of air at the top of your deck.
Well, how do you win?
So you win using our good friend Karn the Great Creator, which you're playing four of. Karn the Great Creator can find the Mystic Forge.
I hope Marshall edits Karn on my face while I'm doing it.
Oh, I see what's in the sideboard now. I get you.
So you can get Paradox Engine and you can get Mystic Forge from your sideboard to go off. Then you also have like random, you know, sideboard cards that you can get main deck. You have Tormod's Crypt, Ratchet Bomb, Sorceress Spyglass, but you also have Aether Flux Reservoir, which is typically how you win. It's just a Karn fetchable
cannon.
Yeah, it's just a Karn fetchable win condition that, like, once you've generated all this mana and played all these spells, you just continue on for, you know, three more spells and gain.
Do you ever win attacking with Guardian Idol?
I have not won attacking with Guardian Idol, but I have won attacking with Metalwork Colossus.
Ah, that
which
makes
is
sense.
In the sideboard as a little, you know, 3 mana 10/10 or whatever.
Back up in case you try to Reservoir and they figure they counter it or something. Like,
yeah,
sometimes you'll end up with like Power Stone Shards. Like, I think the game where I won with Colossus, I had like 2 Power Stone Shards and a Guardian Idol or something, and my opponent is like playing creatures. They've like answered a bunch of my threats. I'm kind of out of gas. I don't have a Paradox Engine or a Mystic Forge, but I draw a Karn and I just fetch Metalwork Colossus and play it. And they like chump it for a couple turns and then die. Because they
it's
were
the
like
this, and then it's a, just a 10/10. Right.
Yeah, like I couldn't assemble my combo. I had no combo pieces. They had like spent all their resources removing all my threats, and then I just like played Metalwork Colossus.
So the last cards in the main deck, and then the go through the sideboard really quick. Well, I guess let's go through the sideboard now because they're all Karn attached. So you have Tormod's Crypt, because Grafdigger's Gage is bad for you, and Tormod's Crypt
is bad. It is bad for me. Yeah,
is the little crypt that could.
I want to both cast spells from my graveyard and from my library, so Grafdigger's Cage is getting me on both sides.
You have 3 Aethergusts and 3 Negates, which are kind of really your main sideboard.
Those
are
actual sideboard cards.
Yeah, you're bringing those in. You have Ratchet Bomb, Sorcerer's Spyglass, Aetherflux Reservoir, another Mystic Forge, a Forsaken Monument, which is the new card, right? It makes everything...
Yeah, it's a 5 mana. It gets all your creatures big, and it triggers when you do stuff.
Yes, I am not actually sold on Forsaken Monument, and I may cut it for a Maze Mind Tome.
Okay.
It was in the Crokies list, and I have fetched it a couple times, and I'm pretty sure it's like been correct, but it's kind of a weird one in that it doesn't contribute to your main game plan, and it doesn't really act as like a sideboard card or a win condition at all. It just kind of like makes you do everything a little bit better.
It's played in all the colorless, those win more colorless.
Right?
Yeah, it struck me as a little bit win more.
Like what about it, like, well, let me finish the last cards before we get into maybes, but sorry, finish with the Forsaken Monument.
Yeah. Forsaken Monument, Paradox Engine, which you're fetching to combo, Meteor Golem, which just answers whatever, and then a Metalwork Colossus. And then the last cards in the main deck are 3 Paradox Engine, 3 Extinction Event, which Extinction Event is just like the interaction that Crokies was playing main deck because of meta reasons. I've liked it because... it does just single-handedly beat creature decks, and like you're going to have a tough time game one against control decks a lot of the time anyway, so you might as well just like kind of
hedge your bet.
You gotta pick one of those matchups that you want to win in the main, and I think Extinction Event is fine. I haven't wanted to cut it, although you could cut black. It's the only black card in the 75, but I've liked it. Relevant lands, you're mostly just playing a blue-black mana base, but you're playing 1 Blast Zone, which is important for killing random stuff. It's like good against the Auras deck. I use it to kill Grafdigger's Cages a lot post-board. 3 Buried Ruin, which just allow you to like get back combo pieces, or you can use it to reset the top of your library if you're desperate, because you can like get back a Chromatic Sphere or whatever. Inventor's Fair also searches for combo pieces and resets the top card of your library and gains life, which is relevant. And then 4 Radiant Fountain, just because your colored requirements are very slim and it's a colorless land that keeps you alive.
Yep, you are not doing a lot to stop being punched in the face, and this stops a little bit of that punching in the face.
Yep. Plus, like, Mystic Forge does pay life, like, when you're activating it and untapping it and activating it again. So you want to have a healthy life total when you're comboing, because there's been times where I'm, like, at 5, I assemble Mystic Forge Paradox Engine, I play the top card of my library a couple times, and I'm like, well, can't pay life anymore, guess I'm dead.
Because Mystic Forge, what, you have to pay 1 life to tap it,
yeah,
and remove or something?
You tap, pay 1 life, exile top card of your library.
Okay, gotcha.
And now, so, what are some of the cards, like... Like, the one that's coming to mind immediately is the, as just, like, good answers to what people are doing. You basically, like, if Forsaken Monument is a card you want to cut, because it's just kind of more win more than it is. It's proceeding to a game plan that by the time you are able to get it, you should be able to do with other cards you fetch for it, it feels like, right?
So, like, if you can reasonably pay 5 for Forsaken Monument, and it's actually doing something for you because you have, like... a bunch of spells to cast to gain life, or a bunch of mana rocks in play to make mana, like you probably just want something to either spend that mana on that's proactive, or you want something to like help you cast your spells. That's not, I don't know, seems weird.
Yeah. What about the monument? I'm trying to remember the actual name. Not Forsaken Monument. It's not monument. It's the your spells cost your opponent's spells cost two more, and you and lose a life a turn.
Godfarer's
statue.
That card's messed me up a couple times.
Meh, not because like once you
it's probably
it,
playable.
You, okay.
So there's a version of a deck that's played a lot in Historic, and I'm sure you guys have played against it. That's like the colorless Planeswalker deck. It plays a lot of these cards. It plays Maze Mind Tome. It plays Guardian Idol. It plays Karn. It definitely plays God Pharaoh's Statue.
Ugin.
And I've played against that deck
Ulamog.
Yeah, and it's trying to go
and
over
they,
the top.
They use, and they Monument. Use Forsaken Monument to cast Ulamog because like all their lands are colorless. So it basically like doubles their mana production and does everything else that it does. So they can just go Forsaken Monument into Ulamog super easy.
So it seems like this deck is just it's taken out all of the chunk and it's just a full on combo version of a lot of the same feeling that deck has. It's just this is the control combo version. And that's the like that's kind of like Tron, I guess, in Historic on some level.
Yeah, that deck is very Tron-like, and my deck is a lot more like a, I mean, it's a combo deck. It's a straight up combo deck. There's nothing controlling Tron about it. I just play three cards main deck to interact with my opponent. Although Aether Spellbomb does interact, but it's also just an efficient egg. And then I will sometimes board up to six cards to interact. Sometimes I'll board in, against Sultai, I board in three Gust and three Negate. And against like aggro decks that are playing red and or green, I'll board in the three gusts and keep in the three extinction event.
So if you were to port this deck into modern, what are some of the changes you would think about making to get started?
I was not super ready for this question, so I was thinking about it while Ben was doing his deck a little bit. I think like this looks like it wants to be an Urza deck, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
First and foremost, Chromatic Star is another good one. You could like go up on that egg because it's so good with Emry and Paradox Engine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think if there's good cards to help you get Paradox Engine to play. And there's also definitely something better than Power Stone Shard.
Oh, yeah.
Like either you would play Talisman of Dominance or like a stronger three mana rock.
You lose Guardian Idol as well.
Yeah, but there's tons of 2-mana rocks. You can play Talisman, you can play Cold Steel Heart,
right.
Or whatever. Guardian Idol entering tapped is actually pretty awkward, because in early turns, a lot of time on turn 2, you go like Weaponsmith and they kill it. In turn 3, you're like Mindstone, mm-hmm. or Mindstone, Guardian Idol, and sometimes you're like Guardian Idol, tap.
I feel like you would play the Tron lands in this deck. Just because it's faster and you are.
Oh, so we could do this as like a blue Tron deck with Paradox Engine?
I just don't think there's any reason that you wouldn't play the Tron lands, even if it was almost trying to execute the exact same game plan.
I think you actually do lose, because like especially if you're playing Urza, so you need double blue, and right, Urza is blue too. Hmm. Okay, you do lose double blue, and like you either have to cut cards for map, right, to be able to search for the Tron lands to try and get them. And then you all like I think like Radiant Fountain, Inventor's Fair, Buried Ruin, and Blast Zone are just more useful than like luck sacking into Tron. And like the best thing you're going to be able to do is like cast Paradox Engine on turn 3, which you already can do in this deck pretty consistently.
I think if you're going up to 8 copies of Stars and Spheres, your double blue is like not nearly something that you're as worried about.
Sure, that was like
I think you're gonna
the smaller end.
I hear what you're saying. It definitely you have to make room for 12. I don't think you play map or any way to search for them. I think they're incidental in your deck because I just think like big mana. And then I think probably more than likely, I mean, if you're fully committed to being a combo deck, that's one thing. I would say maybe you make room for some Thought Not Seers in this deck, because I feel like it's an alternate way to just like have a combo, but also disrupt their game plan and then have a backup way to win the game if your combo's not working. You just have a 4/4 that like gets a card out of their hand.
Well, that's in the Extinction Event slot, right? Like Extinction Event is outclassed in modern, and so you get a ton of different options of like what's your interaction spell, and Thought Not Seer is like a great option.
I will say that Extinction Event as a sweeper with a single pip is pretty nice.
Yeah,
sure,
it's fair.
Yeah.
Like it's single black, so I can cast it off of a Chromatic Sphere, or I can cast it off of just one Watery Grave. The, mm-hmm. the deck's actually only playing 4 Clearwater Pathway, which a lot of times I have to play on blue because like it's my only blue source and I have way more blue cards. And then I'll be stuck with no black source and I have to use a Chromatic Sphere or something. And then 4 Watery Grave. So I just have 8 black tapping lands, and a lot of the time Pathway ends up being blue anyway.
Yeah, you also get access to like some additional good sideboard cards. You get like Pithing Needle, right? You get Academy
Ruins.
Oh yeah,
the sideboard gets way better. Well, so I'm playing Sorcerer's Spyglass. The sideboard card that I miss the most is Ensnaring Bridge.
Sure. Right.
I do not want to attack, and I would prefer if my opponent would also not attack.
And you play most of the cards in your hand pretty quickly, so that makes sense.
I'm like empty-handed most of the time, because what will happen is you'll play out all these like doofus artifacts that don't do anything, and you'll have like two Aether Spellbombs and a Chromatic Sphere in play. And then I just kind of play like that for a little while, because that way I'm like resilient to Thoughtseize. Because if I just like start cracking everything immediately, plus like you don't want to go too low on artifacts in play, because it makes your Emery more expensive, or it like makes your Inventor's Fair, you can't crack it. So I just kind of leave them all in play for a while. Whenever I have extra mana, or if I like need cards, I'll just like crack one.
Buried Ruin is also good. Academy Ruins replacing Buried Ruin is like an easy, like without.
Oh yeah, you put a
Mind
Slaver in your board, and you put a liquid metal coating to do the like liquid metal blow up their lands thing.
Yep. That's actually that's a reason now to more talk towards liking Tron lands is like stuff like Academy Ruins and
You need 10 mana to mine, like, or 12 mana to Mindslaver lock them, 13, including the Academy Ruins. But Paradox Engine makes it a lot easier, because if you have Paradox Engine in play, you tap all your rocks. For Mindslaver, it untaps them, you use that mana to pay for it.
I feel like if we're being honest here, knowing Modern, I feel like we're trying to blend two decks. And actually, I think the reality is that if you're going to try to make this deck work in Modern, probably all that stuff that I was suggesting and any of the additional combo that's just chunky and clunky is probably actually not that good. You probably just want to make this lower to the ground, tighter, faster, more efficient in doing exactly what it's trying to do. And just like replace the slowest cards with the better versions.
Yeah, there's a bunch of cards in this list that there's like a significant upgrade, but like an upgrade that does the exact same thing. Academy Ruins to Buried Ruins, any of the talismans to Guardian Idol.
I want to go heavier on blue and just put War of Invention in this deck. And honestly, like War of Invention probably pushes it way over the top.
So War of Invention is legal in Historic. I actually like Karn the Great Creator better. It is less clunky. Like it's not triple blue. It gets stuff out of your sideboard. You can cast it with Mystic Forge, which is pretty important because when you're like comboing, Karn is the card that you're casting to get Aetherflux Reservoir and win. So I kind of like Karn as a tutor better than Wurr. The one thing about Wurr is if you wanted to be more interactive, you'd be Wurring instead. So like the Wurza decks of old, where people are playing like interactive spells, Archmage's Charm and Cryptic Command and Remand and whatever. And then like, you know, if you have mana, you can also Wurr on the end of their turn. You're like always passing with mana up. You could do something like that with this. But the deck that I'm playing is a pure combo deck. There actually is like a more controlling version that some people played at the Zendikar Rising Championship. Some Kai Buda was playing it, as well as some people on his team. And I'm not trying to snub them and be like, Kai's the best, but he's the one that Channel Fireball tweeted out his list. So I don't actually know who else is playing it, but I'm sure it's other great players. But they're playing like a Sultai version of this that is much more controlling. They're not doing the Mystic Forge thing, so they're not as all in on the combo. But they're still playing 4 Emery, 4 Paradox Engine. They're not playing all the trinkety artifacts, so no Buried Ruin, no Inventor's Fair, nothing like that. You're just trying to draw into it using like Uro, and they're playing Jace Wielder of Mysteries as a wing con that also draws you toward your combo. Right. And then they're playing like 2 Fatal Push, 3 Tameo Collector of Tales to find your combo pieces and get them back. 3 Uro as a backup wing con, 4 Kinnan to like kind of turbocharge your mana production, and also I guess it only digs for Uro. But
so I feel like if you look at this list and you ask yourself the question, and I think this is the same question that we would ask ourselves on the list we were just talking about before, Alex, in last episode, about the Urza, about the Gideon deck, it's like, what's the card in here that was printed that was like pushed in a really cool direction that makes the deck work? And obviously that in that particular deck, it's Gideon. In this deck, is it Paradox Engine, or is it
I think it's Karn.
No, I was gonna say the other, the blue
Emery. You're gonna say Emery.
I was gonna say is it Emery or is it Paradox Engine? Do you think it's Karn?
I think it's Karn. I mean, like I think like Paradox Engine is the artifact combo that is cool with this that allows you to untap all of these things and do that storm effect. So maybe it's Paradox Engine, and that's like the engine of the deck. But Karn...
So I will say that this more controlling version that people were playing at the Zendikar Rising Championship is not playing Karn. They are just a Paradox Engine Emery deck that is like in a mid-range shell.
Okay.
I think that's still strong.
To me,
what we would do in Modern if we were playing like Urza and maybe Wurr and stuff like that is we would be more of this like mid-range shell instead of what I'm doing is like a pure combo where you're playing like,
dig of, like,
you know, Karn instead of Words.
Yeah. Stuff.
I think they printed lots and lots of powerful cards over the years, and especially when you get up to the mana cost of something like a Paradox Engine. It's a really cool card, but it's expensive, and like you definitely have to, you have to go for like a chunky strategy to make that work. It's not like aggressive, really. It's just like a very powerful card. There's lots of things that cost 6 or 7 or 8 that are powerful. But Emery is like specifically pushed so that like it's basically a one mana card that repeatedly flashes something back, that like gets cheaper, that fuels itself by the mill. It's like a really pushed card. I feel like that card's the one when I look at it that I'm like, it's a card like this that enables some crazy shenanigans like this, even in an aggressive format like Modern, because there was nothing like this card before. Like there was nothing that could even do a small impression of it.
I agree with that.
I do like all three of us have different answers. I also think it's interesting that like all three of these cards are bonkers.
I think Paradox Engine and Emery are definitely doing the most heavy lifting here, and there could be a version of this deck that doesn't contain Karn, and probably one that doesn't contain Emery, but it'd be worse. But there is no version of this deck, at least in Historic, that doesn't contain Paradox Engine. Now in Modern there is, because there's plenty of other either like Emery, Urza, like kind of value decks. Maybe they have a combo, maybe they don't. And there's plenty of like Emery based combo decks as well. They're using Thopter Sword or name your combo, right? Like the one that's available in Historic is Paradox Engine. So I think like Paradox Engine is the linchpin of this deck in Historic, because there's like, it's the best Emery deck, I think. I think like if you want to play Emery in Historic, you probably should be playing Paradox Engine in your deck. But in Modern, I would say that Emery is the linchpin card, and you don't need Paradox Engine. Yeah. You can pick your favorite combo, or just use her for value. She's just amazing. And in like, it's kind of funny because Luris is also kind of a better Emery in a lot of ways, but not in this deck, because in this deck, with Paradox Engine, you're untapping her and like able to use her multiple times. And Luris, there's no way to cheat him like that. I mean, I guess you can blink him.
Luris is true? Yeah. You can wait, if you blink Luris, you get another instance. Yeah.
That's why I play Deadeye
Nobody's
Navigator.
Nobody's really doing that because blink spells aren't very efficient, but
I like play Deadeye Navigator in cast decks, and it lets you blink cast, and then you get to do like a snap caster mage on your turn invitation and just keep repeating it. It's sweet.
I had no idea.
But Luris being able to do his thing without summoning sickness is pretty busted. Also, he gets to start in the command zone for some reason.
Well, not in this deck.
No, not in this deck. I just mean, like, it's in funny life. That Emery is this card that everybody saw it when it came out, and they're like, this is crazy. Why would they print this? And then, like, what, 6 months later, they're like, what about this?
Well, that's, like, that's the problem.
It's in your command zone, and it doesn't need summoning sickness. And
That's the problem I'm having with commander decks, where, like, basically I now have just, like, 8 different decks that are basically Emery and or Luros and or Marin and or, like, it's all just, like, you get to cast a card out of your graveyard once a turn. What's the cool thing you get to do with it? And they're all really fun, and I love playing that way. You do take like 20-minute turns, though, which makes me feel like a bad person.
So this deck in Historic, if you want to play it, obviously we'll be posting the list around so that people can try it for themselves. But it's so much clicking and a little bit of full controlling, because there is a trick with Mystic Forge where you... if it's untapped, you cast the top card of your library, but you want a full control so you can see what the next card is before your Paradox Engine resolves. So then if it's a land, you can exile it, then Paradox Engine resolves and untaps your Mystic Forge. So it's like tons of clicking and floating mana and like dirtling and
it sounds like the kind of deck I would never want to play on stream, because I would want to jump out of a window. So
disclaimer, it's a little bit miserable to play, but once you get used to it, like I enjoy playing it, and I play it for fun all the time, and I'm not doing super well in the ladder because your goblins matchup and your blue white control matchup are not very good. But everything else has been fine against. So the extinction events help.
The full control thing reminded me that the one card that I might add to the Gideon list that we talked about last week or yesterday or on this podcast, depending on how you're listening to this, is some amount of discontinuities. Because you can use your turn ending turn version to save yourself if like you just like have to go for it on the Pact or the Glorious End. Glorious End's at the end of your turn, right? So you can like Glorious End them and then discontinuity on the end of your turn if you got them. It's like not the best use of you're discarding two cards, you don't get the value out of it, but it like works like Angel's Grace does, and you can, you know, there are times where I'm like, oh, I Glorious End here and I win, or if I don't Glorious End here I lose, but I don't have a way to not die on my turn. And you still go for it, and then sometimes you dig on your turn and you get Gideon, and you're like, I'm the champion. This is the best deck ever created.
But this would be like the Angel's Grace slot, kind of, right, like in Ben's modern version, where it's like, it's not plan A, but sometimes you just gotta not die.
Sometimes you cast a card that said you lose the game, because they cast a card that basically said you lose the game, and this makes it so you don't lose the game.
It is kind of unfortunate that discontinuity is not very good with Pact. It's pretty much only good with... Yes. Glorious Ascendant.
Yes.
Well, you lose your turn. If you have to pack them, you gotta.
How much does discontinuity cost again? Cost
it's
four?
Two on your turn and six on their turn. Six on their turn, you just two make on your them turn? Lose. Yeah. On their turn, it's if you get to six mana, which this deck does, insane card.
It is weirdly worded, Ben, which is probably why you thought it costs four, because instead of saying it costs one and a blue to cast on your turn, it says it costs two blue less on your turn, which is kind of a weird template, and I would be interested to hear why they picked it. But
I did not realize that. That's actually really sweet. That's like a really cool. It's only two mana on your turn.
Yeah.
So actually, that works really well in the trick. So that was the piece of the deck, and this is last week's episode. So like we're
This is the yesterday audio only same episode. People are gonna have to deal with the world. Go watch. This is all conversation. If you haven't, make sure to watch the whole historic Jeskai episode released yesterday. But if you're listening,
the thing I forgot to mention with that deck, and the reason that deck was cool, is that you're playing four trick bind. And the idea being you can play a Delver on turn one. This is back when Delver was the creature. You would flip your Delver accidentally sometimes, and then you would trick bind a fetch land. And you got you basically were getting like Delver Stifle, but you also have trick binds in your deck to stop you from losing your own pacts. So it had that like really cool, that cool angle as well. And it never worked as well as I wanted.
Rogue Delver.
Yeah. Never quite had the angle that I wanted, but that was like sometimes it would totally work where you would play a Delver on turn one and then you would get to trick bind their land, and like it was such a feel bad moment for them, and it was just amazing.
Just play Shadow of Doubt, go crazy.
Yeah, I would love me some Shadow of Doubt.
There's a new card you can play now too, right? Oh no, that's not in Modern. It's the black stop fetch lands.
Oh, the
opposition agent.
Thank you.
I want you to know I added opposition agent into Jury last night.
Oh no, you need to actually cut it.
Why?
It's unmanageable in online
play. Oh, in online, it's like not fun because
it just doesn't work. I don't have a way to.
You can't search another player's deck.
I don't unless every single player has their deck list online already uploaded to a website, which I haven't done for most of the new decks I'm playing. It doesn't work. In fact, someone casted against us in that CDH list game. And they I had the old list I had of the deck that I sent them. And the one card that they picked to search for was the card that I had not added yet from like the update that someone did. So I like pretended that they got it. And I just like took a random card out of my deck that I think was real, was the card that I cut. And I was like, hopefully they don't call me on this.
No, I feel like you were like, you can't search for that card because it's in my hand, but it wasn't actually in your hand. Is that what you're saying?
No. That's that we've now had opposition agent cast against us twice in Commander
Games. Okay, the other one.
They went and got the 2/3 flyer that like lands enter play tapped and players can't search or whatever, something like that. The Zendikar hate bird, but I don't want to deal with that on stream. And I know there are guests that have said I will leave a game if someone casts opposition agent against me on a live stream. And I'm like, yeah, I own one. I opened one in my commander box and I just can't play with it because
I should go buy a box of Commander Legends. It seems like a super sweet set though.
It's awesome. It was really cool to open. You can do like also sealed league things that people are doing, which are fun. I think we're going to do two episodes this week, I think, versus every day. But I think that's fine. I think we're at an hour, unless we want to talk about Jury and do one more deck. But we're already an hour and a half recording. So I think we're okay.
No, I'm cool. I'm definitely.
Did I take too long?
No. I think deck tech's already 30-minute activity, not a 20-minute activity.
I think
how would you port this into Modern takes up a good
which is
5 minutes per deck or whatever too, right?
I we're trying this whole and to people listening, this is something I'd love feedback on. We're trying this new split the videos into multiple videos thing, right? We're seeing how this works just to see if just like smaller bite-sized pieces of content are more fun for people, and so we'd love your feedback on if you like this type of thing. We've done it now for a couple weeks, and this week's gonna be a little different. It's gonna be two different episodes, but I think that'll be pretty cool. cool. And Marshall, I think, has like a backlog top deck he might be able to release or whatever. But yeah, please in the comments, let us know what you think of the new release content. Thank you guys for joining today. As always, thank you, listeners. Thank you, patrons. You are the people that make this podcast happen. You make it work. And for those who are just tuning in, make sure to check out the Patreon. There's cool stuff there. You can get the raw feed of the whole episode. It's a full recording. You get any weird arguments we have. Ben, like, and me, like, got in a small argument about when I said modern or historic at one point, and we had to, like, scrub a whole section. You get that whole thing. And then at the very beginning, there's very a whole...
Excellent value. You can get the...
the weird mistakes. But you do get a cool 10 to 20-minute pre-show that is, like, just us talking about something random today. We talked about NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, and we, like, played a little quiz game on Can You Name All the Different Members. So definitely check out the Patreon. You get a raw feed there every week. And you get the episode a week early, so we record Tuesday, and then episodes start coming out the following Monday. The raw feed is up Wednesday, the day after we record. So you get super early access plus extra content. So definitely check that out. And then you can please follow us on all the things. Please subscribe. Please like. Please follow us on Twitter. I'm at Kes Wiley.
You guys can find me at Ben Bateman Media. Don't remember to leave a comment below. Comment on the video. Let us know if you liked it. Michael, where can I find you?
I'm at Dudard on Twitter, Dudardd.
And then also, please, every Monday we're doing a live stream of Commander on YouTube and Twitch, twitch.tv/KesWiley, which I'm Kes Wiley, KesWiley, everywhere on the internet, and including Twitch. And so we do live streams there. And then also on YouTube. So if you're a subscriber on YouTube, you can see it there every Monday, 7:30 PST, PM, not AM. We're not masochists. And thank you guys so much for listening and watching, and we'll talk to y'all next week.
Bye, guys.
This has been a production of Time Traveler Media, sending podcasts into the future.